The following presentation from the Utah Open Source Conference held August 28th through 30th, 2008 is underwritten by the Utah Governor's Office of Economic Development with a mission to provide rich business resources for the creation, growth, and recruitment of companies to Utah. goed.utah.gov. Streaming and podcast hosting bandwidth for this and many other presentations at podcast.utos.org has been provided by Tier 4. The presentation entitled Open Source and Government was a panel with Pete Ashdown and Phil Windley, moderated by Jason Hall.
This will be moderated by Jason Hall. He is a founding member of the Utah Open Source Foundation, Society Association Foundation, and former president of Plug, and a developer on the FreeSite billing system. I was also told that there was more bio coming about him, but that bio has yet to show up. So I'll turn the rest over to Jason to do the rest of the introduction. Thank you. Actually, the main applause will be given to some of our other panel members here. And what we wanted to do is have an opportunity to discuss the concept of open source in our government, from the concept of using the technology finally in whether political, military, other government purposes, but also the concepts that make open source important to us. How can we get those to apply to government itself so we can have the transparency that we love in our political process? So to bring that in, we invited two members that are quite respected in our community for various reasons in government as well as in open source. So I wanted to introduce them real quick. First, we have Pete Ashdown, if you want to stand up. For anyone not familiar with Pete, I don't know where you've been, but the founder of X Mission, the greatest ISP in the state, also an important person. He's brought a lot of open source concepts to the politics in helping to kind of expose some of the stagnant infrastructure that we all know is our local political process by really opening up a wonderful Senate campaign that I know many of us helped around with, but also is a great opportunity to participate in a campaign in a way that we hadn't been able to before. So we figured that would be a great way to bring some light to all of us and how what he learned could be applied to other campaigns in the area. So our second panelist is Phil Windley, who's former CTO for the state, well-known entrepreneur. All right, now it's now former professor at BYU, or in 3 days, former professor at BYU, running his startup Kinetics, which he's been blogging about. If you've ever paid attention to the Utah Open Source Planet, it's a great place to get an aggregate of feeds. He's on there also, but we've been able to follow along with blogs the startup of his company, which has been a very interesting insight into that development. But he has some great views of how the state process works and some of the difficulties he had in getting open source concepts to be accepted by our state, and knows about some of the roadblocks in there in terms of technology and acceptance.
Well, at least
two. Yeah.
I know about.
Right. So I figure a great way to start is open it up to you guys first off to say what you might see as current events in open source and our government and politics. So if we want to start maybe with Pete here.
First, I'd like to give a little refresher on my campaign because it's been almost 2 years since election night. When I started out, I didn't envision an open campaign. I didn't know what I envisioned. I was literally thrown out into the water and expected to learn how to swim. And when you run a campaign on a federal level, what you get are a lot of consultants from Washington, D.C., kind of circling the waters, trying to sell you their services with cash up front, of course, to help you figure out what you're supposed to do. And I backed up, I didn't listen to any of them, and I kind of built a laundry list of what I wanted on a website. First thing I wanted was a calendar so people could see what events were coming up and what I should be doing. The second thing was, you know, setting up a mailing list. Third thing was setting up credit card processing to make it easy for people to donate money. And the fourth thing was a wiki, because I'd used the wiki quite extensively at X Mission and documenting our policy and procedures. We've since moved our help pages that we give to our customers all online to a wiki. It was a much easier way for us to run a company documentation system rather than reprinting the employee manual on a yearly basis. To have it all online and where we could edit it and make changes and allow the employees to update policy and procedure as needed. So I thought a wiki would be a good organizing tool. And what happened is the wiki kind of became the most important part of the website, because running for office, you walk into it and you kind of feel like, at least I did, I felt like I had a kind of a fuzzy area around me around certain policy topics. You know, do I really know much about healthcare? Do I really know much about energy policy? How do I find out more? And so I thought, well, what I'm going to do is put out my thoughts on these different policies on the wiki and then allow anyone who wants to come in and criticize or put up their own thoughts and try and build some policies in an open fashion. That idea had never been tried before in a political campaign. There was always this brick wall between the electorate and the candidate, and their advisors. So there was quite a lot of attention that was directed towards my campaign because of that strategy. But I've been disappointed that since the close of the campaign, nobody else has really picked up on that. I haven't seen any other campaigns try and draft their policy and procedure using wikis or in an open fashion. There's certainly been the YouTube debates where people could submit questions openly, but it was still a very filtered process. Maybe if I had won the election, there had been more invitation, but I was hoping that it would be an example that could be carried on by other candidates out there. And I haven't seen anybody this cycle that's doing it to that extent. I think it's strictly a success strategy. If people look at success and want to imitate it, it's not a matter of people, a matter of candidates saying, I want to be as open as possible in my campaign and open as possible in my office, so I'm going to follow these strategies. But it is funny, though, because I heard, I think it was NPR, who collected a group of voters in Ohio, and they went down and ran down all the issues. They ran down all the issues like health care and the energy policies and the war and what was important to them. And time after time again, accountability was number one. Accountability came back, and that's what people wanted from their elected officials. I think everyone in this room, regardless of your political party, can agree that we want accountability from the people we send back to Washington. We want accountability from people we send to the State House. We want accountability in our cities. And I think using wikis and calendaring and open scheduling and open meeting policies on the internet is a great way to bring us that accountability. It's just going to be a little slower than I thought. The other thing is, I think a lot of candidates look to the internet as a real gold mine for harvesting donations from all over the internet, from all over the world, for that matter. On a federal basis, you can't take donations outside of the United States from non-American citizens, but you could take them from Americans living abroad. So the internet is viewed by a lot of candidates as this real gold mine. I think if you're a presidential candidate, it probably is. But if you're any other kind of candidate, it's still a very hard proposition to raise money on the internet. Out of the $200,000 I raised for my Senate campaign, about a third of that came off of the internet. The rest of it came off face-to-face meetings, phone calls, and functions. So I think the internet at this stage is a lot like television was in the early 50s. where people knew this was going to be a force for politics in the future, but they really hadn't gotten their minds about, around how to reach everybody through it. Yeah. Oh. Yeah, they're mostly, probably on average about 75. But the question was asked about my internet contribution size. So the average donation was about $75. I'd probably say the most I got off the internet was probably a $1,000 donation. But those were few and far between.
So one thing I picked up was right at the beginning, you mentioned that the parallel of starting your campaign was a lot like jumping into the water. You know, you got the shark swimming around not knowing what to do. Now, I kind of see that immediately in the open source world. A lot of times we jump into projects the same way, and that's what causes us to reach for new ways to solve problems. Do you think that there's any more parallels with that in terms of things you could do and how it parallels the open source world?
I think it comes back to specialties. I mean, there are people out there who understand driver creation. They understand different languages better than other people, and drawing them in on an open source project is people are going to gravitate towards their specialty. In trying to come up with the best policies, I think farmers should be the ones being asked on agricultural policy, and scientists should be the ones being asked on energy policy, and people who feel like they have an issue, no matter what it is, the government is going to affect that in one way or another, unfortunately. And being given an avenue to speak their mind on that issue, they're going to do that. Whenever an internet-related bill comes up at the Utah State Legislature, and to some extent the federal Congress, I try and give my input on it because I know it affects what I do and what my business is. But I don't know where to start with on a number of other topics, but giving those avenues and opening it up and asking for help, the help will come. There also is the problem of being lost with everyone else asking for help. I mean, if you start an open source project and it's minor and nobody else is interested in it, or you can't get the word out that people want it to attract contributors, the same thing can happen in government. But I think with if the state has been very good at putting on the legislative bills and the drafts of bills up on the website, if they did something like adding a commentary section to those bills, you would get an enormous amount of contribution on that. Now, reading KSL.com and reading SaltLakeTrib.com and some of the commentary that goes on there is a little disheartening because I think the anonymous commentary really comes down pretty hard and doesn't always enlighten the discussion. So I don't know if it would be a matter of non-anonymous contributions only on the state website, but I think they at least should open it up a little. Maybe Phil can talk a little bit more about that. Yeah.
On that note, contribution and anonymous people, do you think that's an hindrance? Like WikiSpam and the silent or vocal minority that tends to say a bunch of stuff behind the anonymous banners?
I guess the question is, how can you have an active wiki and deal with the management of the anonymous contributions? When I first started my wiki in the campaign, it rolled on for about 4 months without any spam and without any vandalism. And then one day after that, I got hit by a number of vandals that were just, it was an onslaught, and I was like there till 1 a.m. doing reversions and backing things out, and I thought, I can't stay up all night doing this. I got to go to an event in the morning, so I locked it down. And after that point, we did have to use a registration system where you'd register and you'd send an email to the staff and ask us to grant you permission. That was unfortunate that we had to do that because it really did slow down the contributions. But I look at something like Wikipedia, where they have such an army of maintainers that it's hard for the vandals to get through that, and think that if the government did put up a central wiki, that you would also get another army of maintainers to keep it proper. I have to. I have, and I went back to my business after the campaign, and there was a lot of work to be done there. But it's still something that rides on my mind that I would like to document. So one of the things I said during the campaign was, I'm not only here to run for what I think is a very poorly managed office. I'm here to inspire other people to run. Because if you look at the makeup of our representation in Washington, it's career politicians and a lot of attorneys and very little else. I think we should have mothers and firemen and service people and a whole spectrum of America representing America. ISP owners. Well, and think about it. Who can you look at in the Congress, the federal Congress, that really understands technology? Well, Senator Stevens. Just a bunch of tubes. Yeah. So we need to have better representation in Congress of the American populace, and the way we get that is inspiring people to run. What I got when I ran was this peek behind the wizard's curtain, where I realized that this really is not something you need to climb the ladder for. Anyone can do it. And I looked at some of the other campaigns that were out there, and we were passing them in leaps and bounds, and we didn't know what we were doing. So I think how-to is something on the future slate. I would love to write a larger document about the whole idea of democracy and technology and what how that will revitalize democracy, in my opinion.
All right. Well, you mentioned a couple of the tools that were really important. The wiki was really important to you, and then the concept of maybe future commentary. But I think the anonymous comments probably spiked something over here with the whole identity. I know Phil would love to talk about identity a bit. But here, we'll turn the time over a little bit to him. If you know any other tools you might think of.
My favorite, or the thing I think of first when someone mentions open source in government, is a meeting that we had in 2001 in preparation for the Olympics. One of the things that we were quite concerned about, and not unduly concerned, I don't think, was that with the increased attention that Utah was going to gather, we would become the victim of more attacks than normal. I mean, every large website is the subject of multiple attacks. We wanted to make sure we were prepared. And so we had a number of meetings. I kind of came into this. I kind of like became CIO, and they said, oh, there's all these meetings going on. You probably need to go to them. So I started going. Well, one series of meetings was about intrusion detection and what system should the state select for intrusion detection. And they were looking at vendors, and I remember we had a meeting where an SVP of AT&T came and was telling us all about, the intrusion detection services they could provide and all of this other stuff. And so we were in a kind of a executive session after all of this, and I looked at the guy who's running the thing, and I said, so why don't we just use Snort? And he said, can we? And I said, why not? Yeah, you can. And so they did. But the assumption was open source was not acceptable, right? That for whatever reason, they knew about Snort. They actually kind of wanted to use Snort, but they didn't believe that whatever powers that had been or were to be would find that acceptable, right? Because it was a free tool, you know, so it was looked on as, you know, maybe not good enough because it's free or what. So I think that there's a lesson there when it comes to open source and government, is that often the question about open source and government comes down to, can we? And if somebody is actively evangelizing and saying, yeah, it's okay, there probably would be more open source in government. Now, you know, the state is a big place, and there are all kinds of things. There's, you know, thousands of Linux servers. There's also thousands of Windows servers, and, you know, heck, there's probably even some OS2 servers sitting under a desk somewhere. You know, there's mainframes and everything else. So you're certainly going to find a lot of open source if you go look at government. You're also going to find a lot of proprietary code, and sometimes that's because in the way that things are done, the idea is we want to buy something and put it in and use it. Right? We don't want to do research and think about it, and I'm not being pejorative, I just mean that those people aren't there. Right? There just is not a group of programmers in certain areas where they're going to go off and figure this all out and build an architecture. What they want to do is they want to go buy a system, put it in, and use it. Right? You're probably not going to find any state very soon building an open source finance project for the state. Right? They're just going to go buy SAP or something and use it because it's there. But there are a lot of opportunities inside government for using open source. On the kind of the theme that Pete got on about transparency as a form of almost open source in government, I think people in this room, I'm assuming almost all of you are from Utah, I know there's a few people from Idaho, but you ought to be thankful that you live in Utah, because we actually have a pretty good legislative system in terms of its transparency. As Pete mentioned, when you go to the state website, go to the state legislative website, you can find all the bills, you can find all the revisions, you can find the calendar of events for every committee, you can find the audio for the meeting after it took place, you can find transcripts of the audio, you can see video. The Senate, at least the majority, blogs fairly regularly. That is not the case, right? If you think that this is like normal, it's not. Most states don't have anything like that. And so we actually are fairly blessed. There are other things, as Pete mentioned, you know, there could be more citizen involvement, or ways for citizens to be involved. We actually are in a pretty good state in terms of how that transparency takes place. Unfortunately, we're not in a similar situation with our federal government. Part of that is because it's got a lot more moving parts, but also because there are a lot of people who would just as soon it not be transparent. And speaking as somebody who has been in a fairly public position in an administration, on the other side of this, transparency really sucks. Not that it's bad or that you think, wow, democracy doesn't need transparency. But it's really, really hard to do business in a transparent environment. It makes things slower, it's less efficient, and as humans, all of us hate that, right? So you'll find people kind of battling against it, not necessarily because they're evil or they have malicious intent, but because it really makes their life hard. And that's especially true in a media environment where every decision that you make comes down to a question of how is this going to be reported tonight at 10 o'clock. And that is always a major factor. And you might say, well, it shouldn't be. You know, believe me, you wouldn't last very long in office if it wasn't. Our government, every government official I know of takes that into account. That's what they think about. It's morning, noon, and night. What's the press going to say about this? And as you know, the press is not necessarily fair, accurate, or kind. They can be vicious. You know, they have 4,000 words to write before tonight at 6 o'clock, and they've got kids to pick up from soccer, just like you. and so they get the job done. So transparency is really hard. And so I'm not saying don't do transparency. What I'm saying is we have to be really vigilant, and we have to also look at the motives of people, and rather than just jumping to the worst case scenario that somebody is being non-transparent because they're trying to hide the money that they took from Zions Bank or something. And that, Zions doesn't give bribes, to my knowledge. But it's usually because it just makes their life really hard. One thing I would suggest to you is there is a thing called Change Congress. You just go Google Change Congress. It is Larry Lessig's kind of follow-on to Creative Commons. And it's about what things can we do to make Congress more transparent, more open, and more accountable, as Pete said, and able to listen to the right kinds of advice. Larry, who is probably on the opposite side of the political spectrum from me, happened to agree on a lot of things. And one of those is that, as I said, people are not necessarily evil, crooks, or malicious, but they live in an environment that causes them to behave in ways which is probably not good for democracy. And that environment is one we, as the American people, have allowed to grow up. Change Congress basically has four ideas that it wants people in Congress to pledge to. I shouldn't say first because I'm not going to get them in the right order, but one is to fundamentally reform the earmarking system, which allows portions of the budget to be spent on specific things that a congressional or a congressperson decides it should be spent on. Now, there's some give and take there because it's a complex issue, but nevertheless, the earmark system causes bad decisions to be made. More transparency is kind of a catch-all, but that's one of the principles. We can all see what kind of bills are put forth. We can all see how people voted on. We can't necessarily hear all of the conversations that took place about them or what other information went into the bill, who influenced the bill, who wrote the bill. All of those kinds of, all that kind of information is generally not available to us, particularly at the federal level. Another part of the Change Congress pledge is to only have publicly financed elections. Now, you may not agree with that. You may have thought about this issue before and decided you don't think that's a good idea because of free speech issues or whatever. I would encourage you to read about it because I used to feel that there was a free speech issue involved here. And I've since changed my mind and decided that the free speech issue is overridden by our need to create a government where good decisions can be made. So I encourage you to look at that. I've forgotten one, and I probably won't remember with the microphone in front of me. So go look at Change Congress, see what you think. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, one thing I would encourage you to do, because if we're talking about open source and government, one of the biggest problems, as I mentioned, for open source and government is just people don't necessarily know how, what, or whether they're allowed to do it. The place where you can have the most influence is your local government. Cities are almost begging for help. You can almost always get an appointment with your city manager or the head of the planning commission. Even in Salt Lake, Salt Lake doesn't have a city manager, but the same kinds of people. These people will meet with you. I don't think just because you're a geek that works in the data center down on 64th South or something that they won't talk to you. They will, and they want to know what you think about issues in your city. They want to know what you think about technology. How could they improve their website? How could they make things more transparent? Are you willing to help? Are you willing to do something? Cities will welcome your involvement. And I believe that local change is probably the first and best change we can make in government because it's so easy to get in. They listen. The downside is they don't necessarily have all the resources they need, but you can make a difference. In cities, so probably my spiel. Yeah.
Something with your apps and your government, like New York, that's North. Do you have any reservations about like how you're going to maintain it, who you're going to find, who else knows something about that?
Not really, because the organization that was going to be doing it was the state central IT shop. At the time, now there's only one, but at that time, and they had about 250 people, highly qualified, you know, network people, you know, people who understood security. There was enough, what's the word I'm looking for, gravitas, I guess, in that group that I didn't have any concerns that they'd be able to figure it out, run it, make it work. Now they have a fully staffed NOC, so that wasn't an issue. But yeah, it had been, you know, the two guys at the Department of Agriculture, you know, not that they're not bright, but there's only two of them, and they got a bunch of stuff to do, so they probably wouldn't have been able to do it. So that is an issue.
Yeah, and then that's just like one small application. I mean, what if you're talking about like an enterprise-level application? Like in my case, my company's product is entirely Microsoft, and that's one of the selling points is that, you know, Microsoft is a known product, you can maintain it, you know, you can get resources to work on the system, and you can find guys that can write code in .NET or whatever, and so that was one of the main products. Like, how would you go about, do you have an example of like an enterprise level application that you're running in government?
I can't think of any off the top of my head, but Bob might be able to tell us something. So Bob is giving examples for the microphone. Bob is giving examples of open source projects. What's an example? So Linux, MySQL, PHP, yeah. Yeah,
you have a vendor,
yeah. Yeah, so for the Mike's benefit, what Bob said is that people in government, and I think this is true in large enterprise too, often want a throat to choke. And so, you know, getting them to understand the concept of community and how that can work and how it can get you past the I want a vendor issue is important. One of the things that I think this question actually brings up is also the idea of training. If you want to bring open source into government, well, you're probably not just going to wholesale replace everything with open source in a week. You have to start off, you actually have to have a program. How are we going to do this? You have to think, how are we going to train people? Because you probably want people who are trained in, you know, these kinds of technologies before you just go put something that might be mission critical. You can start with non-mission critical tools, let people kind of get up to speed and understand them. But I do believe it's possible. Now, at the state level, it's a little bit easier because the state has so many resources. Right? I don't know what the current number is, but when I was CIO, there were about 900 IT people in the state, you know, for 22,000 employees. You know, you got 900 IT people, you probably can get things done. There's probably a couple of them that have programmed in PHP before. You know, there's kind of enough people that you can get something and make it work. Like I said, if you're talking about individual departments, so if you get into a local city, you know, I live in the city of Linden, they don't have an IT department, right? They've got, you know, they outsource everything to some company somewhere, and so it's a little harder. Yeah, Bob? So it's an application that kind of knits together some legacy employee HR payroll apps and...
Well, when I did the solution architecture for it, laid out all of us, laid out the facts, I freaked out with CIO big time. He said, this is all open source.
Now, what does it mean? No. It's a different CIO.
But as soon as we got past all the students, we improved the work is fine. What's going on now? It's great. And it's working.
And that's a better issue, as Bob points out. This education goes both ways, right? You need to educate people above that this is not going to be the end of the world, right? The open source is not going to destroy our systems or get hacked or, you know, whatever other fears they happen to have. The one thing that this discussion has kind of reminded me of that I wanted to make sure I brought up was, you know, several years ago, you may recall this happening in the news, the CIO of the state of Utah, I'm sorry, the CIO of the state of Massachusetts, state of Utah just rolls off the tongue when I say CIO, but state of Massachusetts actually tried to use or require open standards for the way documents were stored. Now, there's an important openness issue there in terms of transparency, there's an important archiving issue, all of those kinds of things. And if you remember, Microsoft brought out the long knives. He didn't last very long. He basically got to the point where his life was hell, and he said, this isn't worth it, and he quit. But there is an important issue there which, as a community, we can help foster. And that is, we can help push for open standards in government because it's the right thing for government to do. And people like the CIO of Massachusetts need as much support as they can get. I've been on the wrong side of Microsoft, and it can be really, really dangerous. Microsoft is basically a legal department with some programmers attached to it. And that's their MO, right? So.
Well, on that note of Microsoft and local communities, I'm involved with my children's school, and my mother-in-law are both teachers, and my mother-in-law comes home last spring and says, someone needs to install PowerPoint 2007 because we're using the new one now, and it seems, and I know at our school there's this fund for, we have to set aside so much for buying new office licenses every year, but we caught it break and now we can use WordPerfect instead and cheaper or whatever. But it's like, in my idea, why don't you use OpenOffice? And I'm just wondering.
That's a great point, because there are a lot of opportunities to use.
It doesn't make a difference to most people if they're using OpenOffice or Microsoft.
Yeah, particularly when what you're doing is teaching kids to write.
Yeah.
Right? They could use OpenOffice just as well. What I don't know, and here's something which maybe you guys do, but I thought this for a long time, but I have no hard data that would actually save them money. And we can say, it must save money, you don't have to buy licenses, but where's the data, right? Where's the report that tells them that? The other problem, Bob's always got a report. the other thing which I would say is that in Utah, where we have such large school districts, it can be really hard to influence their IT policies. Smaller school districts.
If you're anxious to switch to WordPerfect because it was cheaper, why not go all the way to zero?
It's an interesting question, and I think it's one that people in this room could actually start working with their local school districts to ask the question. And you're probably going to have better luck if you attend the South Sam Pete School District than the Alpine School District, just because there's a lot less bureaucratic inertia. I'll tell you a story. I was part of a technology committee that selected grant proposals from school districts to give out state money for technology projects. And I was on it. There were, some principals from various schools on it, and those kinds of people. And we'd get together, we'd review these things, and we'd say, okay, these five get the money. Well, when you got a proposal from South Sam Pete School District, it generally, the assistant superintendent wrote it, and he wrote something like, we want this money so that we can buy this stuff to give students this training in these specific skills. It was very straightforward. We want to give students training to develop specific skills. When you got something from the Alpine School District or the Granite School District, they actually have professional proposal writers. But there are people on staff that do nothing but write proposals all the day. That's what they do. And it was always very fluffy, full of education speak about how it's going to raise esteem, and the clouds will turn blue, and everything was, there was nothing specific in it at all. And so the reason I tell you that is to say, when you start battling with large school districts, you're likely to run up against the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man or the amoeba. You're going to push, and it's going to give, and then you're going to let go, and it's going to flop back, and you know you're not going to get much stuff. You know, it's a good question, and I would love to see school districts spend less money on technology, because it would be nice if we had a computer for every student rather than a computer for every, you know, one out of every five students or whatever we've got. But we need data. We need to work with the school districts. We need examples.
Often we think that the financial question is the biggest driver for homeschooling.
Never. But I mean, that's probably a little unfair, because there certainly are a lot of projects that happen that probably wouldn't happen because there was no budget unless they used open source. But when somebody wants something done and there's budget to do it, the question of what's cheaper probably isn't always up front. You know, now open source could come in with a proposal on a bid that might, but usually by that time open source has already been discounted and we're going after a vendor supplied solution. So yeah, and you'd be surprised at how much money the state spends managing licenses. Right? Not on the licenses, but you know, when you've got 18,000 Office licenses and 18,000 or 20,000 Windows licenses, and you go, you know, you keep going, and now you've got to be able to prove that you've got all of those licenses. It actually takes a lot of people's time to manage all of that. So it's a different issue. There's an overhead involved there. Yeah, so 10% of the cost to do the employee portal with open source. Yeah, so that's my point. I mean, I think there are projects that just wouldn't happen because there isn't budget. But if somebody came up with the idea of the employee portal and said it's going to cost $1.3 million and it gets in the budget as a line item and $1.3 million gets approved for it, nobody's then going to say, well, gee, how can we do it for $120? And at that point, that decision's already been made. It's gone. So
in that case, Novell is your vendor, and then the open office, whatever it is, your product, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that might be part of it. You need a vendor to build the mic.
So open office in state government and schools, definitely, I think it's a good idea from a moral standpoint to get the money, just because it's open and now we can archive it more easily. People can get at it without having to own Microsoft, etc. Sorry, I can't quite hear you.
A lot of the reason we have some of the open office is people here. The people that are using Microsoft feel comfortable or work with it. And open office, they sit back and, oh, I don't know that. And, you know, how do I use that? Not realizing it works just the same as the other.
Yeah, that's true. There's definitely a comfort factor. People, you know, do accounting and have tons of Excel macros may have some legitimate pushback on that, but for most people, they can do just fine with open office. But there is a comfort factor, definitely.
I have a quick comment about that. My dad just recently upgraded his computer, and he was having problems with the latest version of Word opening some older documents of his. So instead of installing Word and telling him that, you know, I didn't tell him. I just installed OpenOffice and said, okay, now it opens your documents, and he was happy with that. So I think a lot of that perception doesn't even need to be informed. You know, I'll confess that the problem I have with OpenOffice is the documents that come in that I lose formatting on still.
And I have to email him back and say, can you send me a PDF? I had that just happen today. So it's still not quite there, but I think for the majority of people's use, it does a great job. Let me add something about what Phil said about Change Congress. The fourth one that Phil forgot was you can only take donations from individuals, and those individuals can't be lobbyists. But does another side effect is that you can't take money from PACs. And if you look at any incumbent congressman, you'll see about 90% of their current campaign funds come from PACs. So when somebody decides to run for office on a federal level, they think, oh boy, I've got to take money from PACs because look how much money they're getting. They're betting on the horse that's already winning. They're not going to give money to the challenger. And so like I was debating whether I should take money from PACs at the start, and it's an easy pledge to sign on to next time because I got about $10,000 in PAC money. And some of that PAC money I wish I hadn't taken because I was thinking, boy, if I don't take it, I'm not going to be able to pay salaries and things like that. But in the end, I could have done without it. Yeah. Well, there's one area that I would disagree on, Phil, with in that that's easy for elected officials to adopt. And it really streamlined things for me in my campaign. And that's the issue of calendaring. I set up a Google Calendar. My entire staff could read it. I could read it from anywhere. And the public could read it. And I think that if you see a congressperson, having a meeting with ExxonMobil, and then 3 days later writing some legislation that has to deal with ExxonMobil and what they do, there's a little bit of a connection that goes on there. And I have Chris Cannon, while he was, I guess he's still in office, but he's tried to take a very advanced approach to some of these transparency issues. And I kept asking him, this is the one thing your office can do that will put you ahead of all the rest, and he still would not accept it. Now, some of them may say security concerns. You know, I don't want people to know my schedule because, you know, some quack could come out with a gun. Well, publish your calendar retroactively. Tell us what you did yesterday. Tell us who you met with yesterday. From my point of view, it really made things a lot easier. And there's so many good, you know, it's not only Google now, but, we use Zimbra calendaring in our office. There's so many good calendaring products out there now. That connect to your phone and do everything else, it really does make your life easier, and publishing them is just one extra step. Yeah?
Could you talk a little bit about signal to noise ratio on the YouTube? Everybody who puts up a cat sitting blog, suddenly everybody's an expert in cat sitting. I just wanted, you know, when you started finding people who registered, were the comments a little bit better at the wrong point?
Well, the registration cleared out the vandals, but it really cut down on the participation. What I noticed about people that would come in and spew some rhetoric is that myself or other people participating on the wiki would ask them to justify their rhetoric, and we wouldn't get any response. With Wikipedia or any wiki, I would argue, the cream floats to the top. The good ideas stand out, and they are taken and expanded upon, while the bad ideas just sink to the bottom. So you can have 10,000 people lobbying for the same idea, but if they all come in and they're repeatedly posting the same idea, it's pretty obvious. But you can have one person with a really good idea that overrides all the majority, and their idea rises to the top. I took that on a couple of issues and went out on the trail with them, and those weren't ideas that came from me or my staff or anybody that was advising me, they came from Americans.
Are there parts of government where we ought to mandate the use of open source software? Not just open standards, but open source software. The obvious one in my mind is the voting machine. I'd really be interested in both of
your answers. I'd agree with you 100% on the voting machines issue. This is I was really disappointed the way the voting machine debate went in Utah, because I think there were some very capable people, both from the University of Utah and advocates of open source software, saying, look, we can do this and show the rest of the nation how it should be done. And they were shut out, in my opinion. I think it should be open. I think it should be on paper. My opinion should be optical scan, and, you know, mark the box. The thing that we do in America is we try to make things way more complex than it really is. The story I've heard about Canada is they have national elections. They decentralize their counting, so like everything doesn't come into the county, and it's actually counted at the precinct, and they're able to count with check marks on paper everything in 4 hours. So I think we try and make things a little too complex, and maybe we don't even need technology at all in our voting system. On the other hand, mandating open source, you know, I haven't taken it from the government perspective like Phil has, but I have a friend who went through the Department of Defense, worked at the Pentagon for about 10 years, now he works with NATO, and he's as Republican as you can get, died an old Republican, so we have a lot of interesting conversations over email, but the one thing he continually repeats to me is, when you get in, please do something about Windows on my desktop, because he cannot stand it, and it's really debilitating in a lot of ways, in a lot of governmental departments. I look at some of the governments around the world, Munich's a good example, Brazil's another, who are starting to adopt Linux to run their governments on, and they seem to be doing an okay job, so I think there's something we can model off there. But the Microsoft pressure, I can imagine, is immense, and how we fight back against that is just getting people in that, in my opinion, aren't afraid of Microsoft.
We'll get Phil's response to that then.
So kind of two different questions. One, mandating open source, and then the second one is mandating open source elections, or what's up with elections. On mandating open source in general, I think my personal philosophy would run more libertarian in that regard, that as soon as you mandate something like that, what you've just done is given it an excuse to not perform. I don't think there's any reason why open source can't win on its own merits without being mandated, that it has enough good about it that government can make the right decision about it, particularly if we all get involved and help. And, you know, there's a lot of examples of that happening. Now, you know, I gave you the Microsoft story. There's also some, you know, pressure on the other side, but I think it can win on its merits. We don't have to mandate it. As for elections, I think that philosophically I would be very close to Pete when it comes to where we ought to be with elections in terms of the technology we use. I have been involved enough in it, not when I was CIO, but since, to understand that there are actually a lot of moving parts there, and I really feel sympathy for people like Gary Herbert, the Lieutenant Governor, and others who kind of stepped into this problem. You know, the current administration in Utah came into office halfway through this decision, after a federal mandate that said you will have these kinds of voting machines. And basically, there were two choices, optical scan or the DRE, the direct recording equipment, you know, basically a computer with a flash card in it. And, you know, I think that it's very hard for people who are not technical at all, who have been used to running elections and understand the security concerns of an election. I mean, these people aren't stupid. They've been running elections for years. They understand how to run elections. They understand that the old system wasn't perfect and it made mistakes. What they don't get, and what's very hard for them to understand, even after lots of discussion, is that when you put a computer in the mix, it becomes a different security concern. It's not that they're stupid. It's that they know that the old system wasn't perfect. They had lots of errors too, it's just that nobody knew about them. What they don't understand is that there is not, is that now we've introduced a way for systematic errors to happen, not just very visible malicious errors or other things. Most of the solutions that have been put in place, even the things like paper trail audits, are actually pretty ineffective. If you have an election which involves as many votes as are cast in a typical congressional district, you can do audits on a reasonable number of machines and catch even intended malice. But when you get down to the level of a House seat, a state House seat, you have to audit about 70% of the actual ballots in order to know with a statistical certainty, a reasonable statistical certainty, that there was no problem with the election. So audits don't solve the problem. So I think we do have a real integrity problem with our election. Now, on the other side, talk to your grandma about what, when she went and used the DRE equipment. I'll bet she loved it. It's so much nicer than pushing the stylus through the thing. People understand it better. So one of the things that's happened is we probably have fewer voter errors now than we did before. So we have made a trade-off. We have introduced security concerns, which all of us in this room understand and almost no elected officials understand. And what they see is fewer voter errors, people are happy. That's the message that they're getting back. You know, there have been some problems with the Diebold equipment in Ohio. I know that that isn't being ignored, but it is, it's a very complicated issue. Now, as for the question of open source, as far as I know, there is an open source voting system project that came out of Australia. I don't know of anywhere that it's been tested in the large. Maybe you guys know. So the question's about, are there projects? Like I said, the only one I know about is the one in Australia. I don't know where that's gone. I don't know that it's ever been used in a large-scale election. So that's kind of the status. Now, let me kind of finish the election, at least my comments on the election, with this. The key problem with using DRE equipment for elections is if it undermines the confidence in the election. At this point, the only people who don't have any confidence in it are people like us. Your mom has more confidence in the election because for them it seems better. Right? So it actually has probably increased confidence in the election system for most people. At some point there could be a disaster and that will change. And that's the real danger, is that there is a potential disaster looming which could undermine confidence in the voting system. But rebuttal, Pete?
Yeah, so kind of the final thing, just before we do go, and just kind of leave it for questions until we actually start filtering out, because some of us do need to get to the other classes. But I think that the big thing we really want to take from here is please get involved, no matter what your party affiliation or what level of government you care about. But like Phil said, really focus on your local government. That's what's going to affect you the most. That's what matters. Please get in there. Talk about open source technology. Offer what you can do to help. Use the community, because all the different loves, like we here at UTSC try and do, is represent the community that's available, whether it's a LUG, a special interest group. All of us want to help. Let's get involved. Let's do what we can to help with the technology as well as the accountability, the introspection into politics. So I hope we can all take that. So further questions, and we'll just pass this along. Anyone?
You both mentioned transparency and the use of open source in government, those kinds of things. I work for a defense contractor, and we run into places where regulations require us to have a commercial nexus throttle if something goes wrong. And then this is kind of twofold. Have you run into regulatory restrictions on using open source, and you mentioned to someone, and also regulatory restrictions on using things that improve transparency? Like there was a movement a little while back to let the federal legislature use Twitter, and people were Twittering some message all over saying, please let our Congress people Twitter. Are there regulatory restrictions that you see that govern both this transparency and the use of open source? And if you have, do you know any of the reasons behind it? Is it just somebody wanting somebody to strangle, or is there something more to it?
I'm not familiar with any state restrictions. Bob, do you know of any state?
No, but this is my goal.
From federal government. Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is that often the states get money from the federal government for various things, and the federal money often has a lot of strings attached. Right. So. Yeah. The question is, how do we get to open source voting systems kind of thing? And I think, I don't know exactly the mechanism to do this, but the key central place where voting system technology is, the standards are created, the systems are evaluated, et cetera, is a group inside NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And I think that if enough people could influence interested Congress people, et cetera, to get that group involved in an open source alternative, that would be what would probably be required. Even if you came up with your own open source project, even if that open source project were wildly successful and you built the best voting system ever and a place like Utah really wanted to use it, I believe that it would still have to be certified by the NIST group before they could, according to the HAVA legislation. So that's one kind of place to look for influence.
Yeah, I wanted to mention something about the regulation issue. I heard about that Twitter thing as well, that for some reason they won't let our Congress people Twitter. And I thought, man, what a golden opportunity for somebody to be civilly disobedient. You know, I would love to see somebody say, this is dumb, and I'm going to Twitter anyway, and then get punished for it. Unfortunately, we didn't see anything like that. I don't know what the final outcome was, but I can imagine there are rules regarding disclosure in the Congress. I know in the state and the federal, they have closed session. Where they're not allowed, they don't allow the press in, and they don't allow any sort of minutes to be taken. I don't see how that benefits anybody. I can see how individual privacy should be protected and national security should be protected, but when they're not talking about those, what is it that they're trying to keep secret? Maybe. I don't know. So I argue that there's very little reason why they shouldn't be completely open, even though it may be a headache. You know, if you've got somebody working on your yard, you want to know what they're doing, and those people are our employees, too.
This will come from the Republican on the panel rather than the Democrat. But I actually have my suspicions that that whole Twitter thing was a minority, a Republican tactic, to put pressure on the Democratic majority for things other than that exact issue.
Maybe. There's a lot of game playing going on.
Yeah.
before you all take off, there are survey forms sitting on the filing cabinet on the left. Please feel free to fill one out and tell Jason what a good job he did. Thanks very much for coming. Also, once again, this room was sponsored by Mosey. Go visit them at their booth and thank them. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.